Thanks to everybody for coming out. For today's panel, I want to thank Ari Abramowitz, Michael Hill, Giselle Huron, and Matt Serkin for helping organize this. And Matt's also going to be leading the program. So come on up, Matt, if you would. I've just destroyed your PowerPoint. Here you go.
A little sneak peek into my PowerPoint. Well, thank you all for coming. This is an exciting time, and I think we've got three great panelists for you. So let me just quickly introduce them, and then we'll get to the slides and the presentation. Dan Schnapp, immediately to my left, is a partner and chair of the New Media, Entertainment, and Technology Group at Hughes, Hubbard & Reed. He provides strategic counsel and transactional support to both broadcast and cable networks, including technology service providers in connection with major TV and programming-based initiatives, including cutting-edge technology. To his left, we have Sandra Astairs, who is the executive director of the Copyright Alliance, a nonprofit educational organization of artists, producers, and distributors. Prior to joining the Alliance, Sandra served as vice president and associate general counsel at Time Warner, Inc., and coordinated the company's intellectual property strategies. To her left is Richard Lev, who was a partner at Frost, Zelnick, Lerman and Zissou. Richard handles trial and appellate litigation involving copyright and trademark infringement and false advertising, as well as licensing for a major smart TV manufacturer. So this is an exciting time, for consumers and for lawyers. Thanks to a slew of internet-based TV-focused services and technologies, the traditional ecosystem of television is changing. And now this is aided by cloud-based transmissions, basically storing things in remotely located server farms and transmitting this content through technology with dynamic advertising solutions is really transforming the traditional norms of TV delivery, consumption, and advertising models. And it's also raising new issues about the application of copyright laws that traditionally secured this space from viable disruption. So before we go any further, you know, the title is Disruptive Technologies. Well, what is a disruptive technology? You know, tons of definitions about this. Every business journal has a different way to define the term. Effectively, it's a new way of doing things. It's a new entrant into the market that disrupts the market. It's innovation in ways the market does not expect. So when we're talking about disruptive technologies in connection with, you know, consumer products, most of which we're familiar with, it's really a new product, service, or innovation that disrupts the established consumption ecosystem. The way we consume television is now changing. It's being disrupted by various products and services. So one of the key drivers in this is convergence. And this is a hot buzzword now in technology lawyer speak. It's really the notion that you have one or more products or services coming together and congealing in one device or one offering. It's a black box theory. The notion is that our devices are now doing more than one thing. Before, televisions could only receive cable or over-the-air transmissions. Telephones could only make telephone calls. Now they can do everything effectively. It's the notion that it's all going to eventually end up in a black box. The Star Trek future, right? Where Captain Kirk just talks to a computer randomly, and the heat goes on, the lights go on or off, TV comes on, someone's operated on. That's where we're heading. And perhaps the best example of this is, I think right now, it's the mobile phone. That's the best example we can probably give of convergence. You can do everything on a mobile phone. You can read a book. You can watch television. You can make calls. You can do video conferencing. What can't you do? You can take pictures, record videos, GPS technology, directions, a compass, everything, a flashlight. What doesn't a mobile phone do? But it has limitations. And these are important. One, it's a small device. It only has eyeballs for one, meaning that it's a small screen. It's only accessible to one individual. And it's, you know, it's optimized for that viewing. And communication speeds. The limitations of our infrastructure, particularly cellular communications, don't allow it to receive transmissions at a speed I think we would like, or, you know, in comparison to wired facilities, whether that be fiber optic, cable, or otherwise. So what is the best example now that we're seeing? It's the smart TV. And that's why this is important. The smart TV is everything without the limitations. Connection speeds, no problem. Fiber optic, cable, wired, grounded, no interruption. How about eyeballs? How about placement? Right in the middle of the living room. Everyone can watch it, right? And what do advertisers care more about than anything? Eyeballs, right? Everyone can see it. So convergence and disruption is best described through the smart TV. Now, the smart TV in and of itself might not be the most disruptive technology, but it represents the platform for the exploitation of the technology, the products and services that go along with it, that are optimized for it. So when we talk about disruptive technology and TVs and all this stuff, what does it really mean? And I can sit up here all day and talk about cloud-based transmissions and dynamic advertising, but let me give a list here, and then you know I'm going to show you a video, which I think will sort of put this in visual terms. That'll be a little more palatable. But basically, we talked about smart TV. Another technology now is automatic content recognition, and this is a hot thing in copyright circles amongst lawyers, technology companies, device manufacturers. This is the notion that in order to optimize the TV viewing experience, to target it better than the average 30-second spot does on your television, which doesn't know who's watching TV, when they're watching it, or otherwise, right, as it could be time-shifted, right, is this idea that if the advertiser or the service provider knows what you're watching, when you're watching it, where you're located, have you paused your DVR, have you changed the channel, what have you watched in the past? That information is all driven by the notion of automatic content recognition. The idea that if the advertiser, at the end of the day, or the content provider knows what you're watching, it can send targeted advertisements to you that are tailored to who you are. You know, this is like when you go in your Gmail account and you open up your Gmail account and you see advertising targeted to the content of your emails, right? They figure out you're a male, you know, you live in New York, you go to concerts, all of a sudden you see a StubHub ad, right? That's driven by personalized ad serving. And that's what automatic content recognition is. And here, let me just show you what it is. And it's driven by this. Excuse me. It's driven by the notion that a video is analyzed, a fingerprint is created, effectively an analysis of data points based on audio and visual content, and it's entered into a database. So you see, we got Sons of Anarchy up here. We've created a fingerprint based on the unique properties of this television show. Light, sound, visual aspects, whatever it might be. And it could be ones and zeros. Or it could be clips. It could be anything, depending on the technology being employed by the particular service provider. All right, so now we have in our database Sons of Anarchy fingerprint. So now when someone's flipping through the channels, the content providers will extract fingerprints, compare it to their database, and know exactly what you're watching. So you can see that there is some value in creating a database, and that's where the gold is, really, right? The ability to know what's on TV is not only limited to serving you ads on your television, but also advertisements and other content on your second screen, right? Your tablet device. How many people now, when they're watching television, check their email or look at other things on their tablet device while a commercial's on? That's become a standard practice and always has been. But now, if advertisers, copyright holders, and networks can grab your attention on other devices, they'll do it through this, right? So your tablet will know, it will hear the audio from the smart TV using their fingerprint database, knowing that, hey, this guy is in my app, but I can hear the audio from the television behind him, and I know he's at minute 5 in the FX show Sons of Anarchy. I'm going to serve him an advertisement for, what, Harley Davidson jackets? I'm going to give him content on, you know, or information on the actors that are in this television program. I'm going to offer him a call to action. Anyone interested in the show, let's meet downtown. So you can see how automatic content recognition is an important aspect of the disruption of television, because it's targeting. It's using the information about us, which makes advertising more valuable, which runs television to a certain extent, right? That and subscription fees. So, but going back to what disruptive technology is. So it's this automatic content recognition. It's TV apps, and I think we all know what that is. That's the apps you have on your mobile device are now on your smart TVs, right? You can watch Netflix, Hulu on your smart television. So basically, you can get content, which is very similar to your television content, over the top, via the internet, which is almost disruptive in and of itself. Second screen experiences, which I just explained, which is being able to look at another device on a second screen while you're enjoying content on another device. effectively the first screen, the television, and then content distribution. And, you know, this is a little more illicit. These are your Aereos, your IVTVs. This is the redistribution of content along the effectively the food chain or the transmission chain, redistributing that content to end users. But let's see if I can do this here. So watch this video and tell me what you think.
Remember a time when TV was the coolest thing in the house? It brought us together, introduced us to rock and roll, and took us to the moon. We watched it evolve from black and white to full color, and go from two channels to 2,000. We went from being tied to set schedules to taking our favorite shows with us. Now, the next revolution is here, and TV will never be the same again. And Sequence delivers on the promise of interactive TV, turning television content into an interactive experience on virtually any device. Viewers can vote for their favorite contestant, instantly see the results, and even download the winning recipe, all with their remote control. Fans of a show can get the scoop on their favorite actors, find out about featured products, and even buy right from the screen. They can also customize the ads they see, get targeted offers, and instantly find a local dealer. Sports fans can get stats and scores on the fly, receive customized alerts, and follow their fantasy teams, all without missing a single play. And kids don't just watch, they participate and learn. Thanks to InSequence, some of the world's biggest brands, most popular TV shows, and most successful programmers and advertisers engage and connect with their audiences like never before. On TV, broadband, and mobile devices. It's revolutionizing the way we watch, learn, shop, and connect. And it's all happening now. InSequence, TV is new again.
So, effectively, the notion being that television is entirely interactive, right? You can do anything now. You can interact seamlessly with the television. You can purchase content. I can be watching effectively a television show and be prompted to purchase goods or services based on what's happening on the television. So if Blake Lively in Gossip Girl is wearing Gucci boots, I can use my hand via my gesture control Samsung Smart TV, click on the boots, and be directed to an internet browser that allows me to purchase them on Amazon. I mean, think about that. I didn't do anything. I moved my hand in a crocodile fashion, right? Which is what it takes to click effectively using the Samsung technology and be entered into a shopping experience. Think about the value of that and the cross-selling that can go on in connection with that kind of offering. So that's where we're going. But, you know, I think a profound concern for cable and broadcast networks is control over the medium. And I think that's going to be the discussion today is really, how about who controls the content and what can happen in connection with this content, right? And so I'm going to quickly talk about a few cases in this area that are particularly relevant. I'm going to blow through these as quick as possible just so we have enough time for the speakers here because I'm already approaching 10 minutes. But effectively, these are a few cases, six cases in total, that speak to disruption in the TV space. The first is the Sony Betamax case, which I think many people are familiar with. This was, you know, 35 plus years ago, when Sony Electronics was sued by Universal Studios and Walt Disney for distributing and marketing the Betamax VCR, effectively allowing private individuals to record broadcast television. Ultimately, the Supreme Court upheld the district court's decision, saying that the private home viewing reproduction for purposes of time shifting was a fair use under the Copyright Act. And also the selling of the Betamax VCR, a staple article of commerce, had substantial non-infringing uses. It could be used in legitimate, non-objectionable ways. Hence, it did not contribute to the contributory liability claims of the studios. So that's sort of the threshold TV fair use case, like it or not. Another case of import in particular now is the Cablevision case. This is Cartoon Network versus CSC Holdings. This was the idea that in 2006, Cablevision had decided to deploy remote DVRs, effectively housing your digital video recorder, which is the next step in the evolution of the VCR, in a remote location, effectively allowing people in their home, subscribers to cable, to use their television remote to communicate with their set-top box to activate a remotely located DVR, effectively allowing people to receive transmissions of their favorite shows that they had elected to record. Ultimately, the Second Circuit decided that the network's copyright infringement claims on the right of reproduction did not constitute infringement, given the volitional conduct involved in the end users, effectively drawing parallels to Sony, saying that, hey, you know, the end user is doing this. This is private, non-commercial use, right, of television, recording it for time-shifting purposes. But I think of import, and what's relevant to this discussion today is their approach to the public performance issue. Basically, now we're transmitting television shows over the internet. Isn't that a public performance? Well, the court said it wasn't. And the court justified its analysis by using the one-to-one dynamic. Effectively, the fact was that Cablevision recorded for each individual on a partitioned hard drive their version of Desperate Housewives, meaning that they didn't use a server copy. They gave every individual a piece of hard drive, right, an area of that hard drive to record an individual copy for that specific individual subscriber that could only be accessed and received by that individual subscriber. Hence, they found it to be a private performance. And why this is important is because when all these solutions move to the cloud, right, you know, even people are storing their own information on their computer in the cloud, it raises interesting questions about what rights, what consents are needed to transmit content from the cloud if it, in fact, is a private performance. If it's just a copy made by a service provider just for me that only I can access, is that a private or a public performance? So an interesting case, and one that had a huge bearing on the Aereo case, which is a popular case going on now involving Barry Diller that I'm sure you've heard about. Next case, as we go through this, this was a preliminary injunction request filed by, or motion filed by Fox against Dish Network. And what did Dish do? Dish effectively came up with the idea that they would sell primetime anytime. The idea that they would automatically record at your request all primetime television for you, stored on your hard drive, without you having to select each individual show. Effectively, you know, X amount of hours every day of pre-stored television. They also offered the auto-hop feature to go along with that feature. Effectively, the idea that they would record that same programming, but strip the commercials right out, right? So you weren't even burdened with having to fast-forward through them later. Effectively, several claims were brought. Some of them were breach of contract involving retransmission consent and otherwise. But what was interesting was that this was a revisiting of Sony again. It was the idea that if an individual was doing the conduct, was volitional, right, that it was fair use. So essentially the idea that commercial skipping is likely fair use was raised, and the court seemed to sign that you could delete commercials. It's important here because the manipulation of commercial conduct, commercial content, is an important thing that we need to be looking at because that really drives the production and distribution and advertising of content that drives the entire platform. No one's sitting in front of a TV not watching TV. Right. Next case is a less well-known case, and I'm going to give this one a short shrift here. But this was a case in 2006 where some religious businesses had decided that they were going to strip any content from Blockbuster and Hollywood movies that was profane, indecent, or blasphemous. So references to God or otherwise were obscured, blurred out, audio was changed, black bars were put on the screen. And directors, producers sued, and clearly won, because these individuals then, after they purchased an off-the-shelf DVD, made an edited copy of it, then rented it or sold it, right? Saying that they were serving the best interest. The reason why this case is slightly important in this new world is that it's the manipulation of content here, and those claims that could be available to a network if their content is being obscured. So if I'm, you know, ABC and I have a show on and ads are being served against it, what am I going to sue for? Obviously, I know what my exclusive rights are under the Copyright Act, but what was interesting here is that the edited versions were not considered derivative works. And so just sort of file that away in your mind for a second here, but it wasn't a derivative work to obscure, fog, delete, add content, black bars. Is a black bar like a pop-up ad? right? So just keep that in your mind, because this really sort of dismissed the idea that it could be a derivative work making these subtle modifications to this type of content. Next case here is ABC versus Area. We talked about this a little bit, but this is, how are we doing on time? We're getting long here. Almost done. ABC versus Aereo. This has been in the newspapers. This is the idea that following the Cablevision holding that we just discussed a little while ago, a service provider has effectively put 1,000 miniature antennas the size of a ring, a wedding ring, on top of a building in Long Island and is redistributing over-the-air content, digitizing it, and providing a subscription service. Right, so think about that. It's effectively a long cord to an antenna. That's their argument. And the issue is whether a service provider can redistribute or transmit this conduct that the public has a right to receive. This is over-the-air broadcast, right? And thinking back to Cablevision, the one-to-one concept, right? Well, they have one-to-one ring. So everyone who signs up for this service gets their own ring that receives the content, and it's then transmitted to them through the stream of content that was accessed and received by that particular ring. So they effectively relied on Cablevision, the one-to-one dynamic, in justifying their service. Now, this is in the preliminary, a preliminary injunction was denied, and the appellate court is hearing oral arguments. But an interesting case because, again, further extension of Cablevision, Sony, and the public performance idea. And then the last case we're going to talk about is a lesser-known case. This is, and again, short shrift here. This is a plagiarism service. Effectively, these are new services coming out where students have to submit their schoolwork to a service which creates a database of other papers to ensure that plagiarism is not occurring. So a lot of school, in college and high school are required as part of passing a course to submit a digital copy of their paper to a service which then compares against your classmates and kids at other schools or students at other schools to ensure that you're not copying. The reason this case is here is because this is one of the first cases that really talks and uses the term digital fingerprint. Because the comparison, which we talked about before in my slide about comparing audiovisual content, right, using fingerprints, was raised here in this case. And the court found that the use of it, to a certain extent, would survive a copyright infringement action, meaning that the use of fingerprints, creating a fingerprint from a student's work, whether it be ones and zeros or the entire work, right, or portions of the work, right, was highly transformative. It had a different application than the original work and was able to survive a fair use challenge. Now, that's important here, even though it's a different scenario, different technology. It's one of the first cases that talks about digital fingerprinting and whether you can create a digital fingerprint and survive of someone else's conduct, content and survive a copyright infringement claim. So here we go. 30 more seconds. So with all that background, scattershot case law, disruption in the space, where are we now? Let me give you a few slides here, and you tell me what you think. If you're the content creator, copyright holder, network, There's your television program, right? Are you okay with that? A guide overlaying your content, right? Cable company, guide, you can pick your shows. That's, it obscures your content a little bit, right? How about if a commercial's on right now? Is that okay? How about this? How about a McDonald's banner? How about McDonald's sponsoring the program guide? How about the voice sponsoring the program guide? And why the voice? Because the voice knows through automatic content recognition that American Idol's on right now and purchased the real estate. So now we have a sponsored program guide using automatic content recognition selling ads against American Idol. Or how about Pepsi? Because Pepsi knows that in this image here, there are three cups. Let's say Coca-Cola on them, because Coca-Cola is the exclusive sponsor of American Idol. How about that? You okay with that? How about a banner ad during your show that allows people to click on that ad using their remote or their fingers and allows them to navigate to the voice on a different broadcast network? How about that? How about Pepsi again? Hey, those, that Coke cup looks Certainly less intriguing when Pepsi just bought the, for a lot less, the ability to buy advertising on American Idol against Coke. Not bad, right? How about an upper right-hand corner, a floating widget, which gives me sports scores and is sponsored by Yahoo. And Yahoo wants it on during American Idol because they know they got tons of eyeballs. And if I click on that, I go to Yahoo's webpage. Or how about this content widget with the Pepsi ad, sponsored by Pepsi. Is that okay? So these are the kind of things, you know, we want you to be thinking about today. And at this point, I'm gonna turn to our speakers. But that's the state of play currently, more or less, in the space. So, Dan Schnapp from Who's Ever to Read. You know, how do we balance the interests of copyright holders and all the other stakeholders here in connection with the deployment of this new technology, right? How do we balance the interests of all these competing parties? We have electronics manufacturers, we have advertisers, we have networks, programmers, distributors, talent, we have directors. How do we balance all this stuff to have a product that's accessible and viable in the marketplace?
Well, I think you have to first start with the principle that the fundamental problem here, I think, is that, and historically, is that the law is rarely written with innovation in mind like this. And it's demonstrated time and time again that technological advancements and innovation are going to routinely and rapidly outpace the law. So being that, as you said, Matt, the TV industry is ripe for disruption, consumer expectation about getting everything at once at any time, anywhere, on any device is driving that. The only way that you're going to see a paradigm shift in the current ecosystem is that all the major stakeholders are going to have to cooperate and deals are going to have to be cut. Certainly there's going to be lawsuits for individuals that feel that they don't have a seat at the table or they're left out, whether it be a revenue stream for advertising that's served or it be a copyright or some other right that might be infringed. But ultimately, in our experience, and you can see that currently happening, you're going to have to sit down and negotiate a deal to address these issues and deal with this by contract.
Well, what's happened in other industries, right? We've sort of seen this disruption. We saw it in music or Napster, MP3.com. There was this explosion of music sites because the technology had gotten to a place where we could all transmit, receive, you know, copy music. What happened there? I mean, is this a negotiation? Is this everyone sitting down at the table and cutting deals, like the networks, the technology providers, the advertisers, and all agreeing to play, you know, play together well? I mean, what is this?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you're talking about. If we're talking about ACR, I think you can't really necessarily draw a parallel to the music industry and Napster, two different platforms. ACR is unique in that the technology...
Automatic content recognition, by the way.
Yeah, sorry. Automatic content recognition that we were talking about that enables all those slides and those hypotheticals that you were demonstrating. It's unique in that it was used initially as an enforcement tool to identify infringing content on the Internet and to either serve a takedown notice under the DMCA, enable somebody to do that more efficiently, or to give them an opportunity to monetize whatever content's out there. Most of it was UGC, end user generated content that was uploaded to YouTube, MySpace, other social networking platforms. Now it's being used to do this, and the issue is that these individual service providers aren't necessarily cutting deals with the network programmers and the copyright holders. They can bypass it. The technology's come so far in that 99% of what they have in that reference database that you were describing before is received and created on the fly in real time by just the broadcast itself. So they can cut out, and the advertiser can cut out, the actual copyright holder.
Okay, well then, Sandra, answer me this. So if now the copyright holder, the programmer, the network, the distributor, whoever it might be, can be cut out, I mean, what... You know, you worked at Time Warner. You know, what rights are implicated here? I mean, who's being threatened here, whether it be talent or otherwise, with the deployment of this technology. If you're having ads served over content and we're sort of losing, the potential exists to lose control, what's implicated and who's hurt?
Right. Well, I think you're right. The issues and concerns are going to arise here when somebody's cut out of the value chain, whether the value is a revenue chain or whether the value is the value of information of what's going on in the transaction. And so there's a variety of parties that are significant in any of these transactions. I mean, when you look at the value of a copyrighted work and the way that the entertainment industry is structured, the value of a copyrighted work in the entertainment industry is measured by revenues that are collected over a variety of distribution windows and a variety of distribution platforms. So you're going to see issues arising primarily where a service is trying to usurp for itself revenue from a platform that has previously been, you know, monetized by way of a license, or an advertiser or a smart TV manufacturer is trying to usurp for itself revenue that has otherwise previously been dealt with through a licensing agreement. And the opposition isn't going to come just from the copyright owner. The opposition is also going to come from other players in the ecosystem, including, importantly, guilds and unions who have what they refer to as like a secondary beneficiary interest in those relationships that the copyright owner has. And a lot of people don't think about the relationship that creative talent has in this space. I mean, creative talent, obviously, you know, you think about the fact that creative talent relies on the jobs, and that, you know, if you're cutting out revenues to a, you know, studio, for instance, or a TV network, TV broadcaster, and you're not greenlighting as many projects, that obviously people are going to lose their jobs, and they're, you know, that's going to be a revenue hit. But there's, you know, there's secondary impacts. Collective bargaining agreements all have residuals clauses, which require the payment of residuals on reuse of content. So that started back, you know, with reuse of, you know, running of reruns in the 1940s, and that's expanded to cover all sorts of other different reuses, including now, through side letter agreements, both in SAG agreements and Writers Guild agreements, for reuses on the internet. And those sorts of reuses are directly implicated when you're talking about things like the Ivy service and some of these other services that try and pretend that they're a different type of, you know, normally licensed service. But don't go through the, you know, the normal chains of licensing. The other, you know, other place where this becomes an issue is in the advertising space. And I think people, you know, don't think about this as much. You know, when ads get cut out, obviously you start thinking about, well, how is the programming going to be paid for? Well, if you're skipping the ads, the programmer, you know, starts thinking about integrating the ads more directly into the programming. So, yeah, you see the Coke cups, that's, you know, program placement. But, yeah, it's easy to override that with that big Pepsi banner going over the ad. So what do you do? Instead of just having placements, you start really integrating the content into the lines that the actors speak and into the plot of the storyline. And so you get really upset writers and upset actors when that happens, because the writers are being forced to, you know, integrate into their writing, you know, promotions that are, you know, just not natural. You know, to make up for the
fact
that
it's... Well, I love this refreshing Coke Zero I'm drinking
exactly.
right now. Is he dead?
Right, because there are legitimate sort of creative complaints as well, right?
This is a great angle.
And the other thing from the actor's perspective that gets raised is not just that they're being, not just that they're being... forced at the last minute to recite these lines that they haven't bargained to recite, but they're potentially losing other promotion opportunities. I mean, if you're doing a pitch for Pepsi on as part of some program that you haven't, planned to do a pitch for Pepsi for, you're obviously not going to be offered the promotion for Coke.
Right.
And that, is limiting your employment opportunities in other respects. So you see that each of these types of decisions, which may seem to you very isolated and not having an impact on the larger ecosystem, actually has very interesting flow-through effects
also,
that people don't consider.
It also has an advertising impact, right? The advertisers, the inventory itself becomes less valuable in that particular example. Coke is going to be ticked off because they paid millions of dollars for product placement in a very popular show that gets watered down and diluted from Pepsi, partnering with an ACR provider to, serve an ad in a banner on the first screen if it's a smart TV.
I think that's a really... I mean, because what we've talked about is sort of these kind of value destroyer, kind of obscuring... But we haven't even talked about replacement. How about ad replacement? There's technology there's a microsecond flash that occurs at the tail end of the program breaks. There's a patented technology for this that allows advertisers to know when a commercial is on or off. How about if they're a little... dialogue box pops up on my smart TV, says, "Hey, would you like to watch a different commercial? How about that? Or how about it just takes out the commercial and you don't even know? It's imperceptible to you. Samsung cut a deal with some advertisers to cut out commercial content. Think about that. Think about the potential with this ACR and these smart TVs, right? We these are banner ads, these are other things, but I mean, obviously, those are the most extreme forms of it, right? But certainly, copyright holders are going to have a major issue with this stuff. And I think, turning to Richard now, I think the million-dollar question is that what drives all of this is the technology in the database, being able to recognize what's on, being able to have access into the innards of, effectively, the smart TV. So who owns these fingerprints? Right, these databases, comprised of references to television shows, so they know when they're on, when they're playing, and when they're being replayed. Who owns that information?
Well, in order to put an ad up for Gucci shoes, the software needs to know not only what show you're watching, but exactly where you are in time. You're 3 minutes and 47 seconds into the show, and it's got to know that particular point Blake Lively is wearing Gucci shoes. So there's a reference database which it creates by taking a digital fingerprint of what's on the screen, and it doesn't do it the way a person would do it by making notes of who's on the screen, the name of the actress, what she's wearing. It's all completely digital based on things like the brightness of the scene, the luminance, the pixel distributions, et cetera, et cetera. It just turns all that into zeros and ones. And then when the show is actually broadcast, the software on your TV set does the same thing again. It takes a digital fingerprint of what you're watching, compares it with the digital fingerprint that's in the database, and says, "Oh, this person is watching Gossip Girls. He's at three minutes and 47 seconds into it. According to my database, Blake Lively is wearing Gucci shoes. Let's put an ad up." Now, my first question would be, by making... Now, all this is usually done by agreement between the copyright owner, the network, the TV manufacturer, which puts the ACR software into the TV set, and the company that does the ACR work, the database and all that. And if there are agreements, then everything should be okay. But what if somebody decided in the first instance, "I'm going to take a digital fingerprint of a TV show"? Is that an infringement of copyright? And arguably, it's not, because it's not making a copy. It's certainly not what I just described with all the digital zeros and ones is not really a copy in the sense that it's substantial or similar, it could be perceived by a human being who would see that this is Gossip Girls. And if it is a copy, then arguably it's fair use. It's only a tiny portion. It has to be done very quickly, so it can only be a tiny portion of what's on the screen. And arguably it's not, for fair use purposes, it's only a tiny portion of the show. And it's not competing with the show because it's just information that's used to tell the set what you're watching. So arguably it might be fair use. In terms of who owns it, I would go back to who owns the database of the who owns the fingerprint of any particular show. I would go back to the case of where West Publishing tried to claim that the pages in its case reporting system, where the case starts and where the case ends and where the sentence is interrupted by a new page, all that does not constitute a copyrightable work. And the Second Circuit said, because the internal pagination of West's case reporters does not entail even a modicum of creativity, the volume and page numbers are not original components of West compilations and are not themselves protected by West compilation copyright. So arguably you could say that this digital fingerprint is not owned by anybody because it's not a copyrightable work. It doesn't involve enough creativity. It's just an automated process that the computer is doing, taking a little snapshot of a little snippet of digital information to put in its database. So the answer might be, A, nobody owns the fingerprint, and B, it's not an infringement or it's fair use to use the digital fingerprint.
But I guess I would question, and having seen some of this stuff when we were looking at anti-piracy applications of the same sort of technology, I would question, first of all, whether the licenses that were negotiated for the anti-piracy applications actually included provisions as to who owns the databases that were being created.
I'm going to go ahead and interrupt because I have some inside knowledge. Dan, I know that you struck and we're on the side of the media companies in forging some of the first ACR deals ever. Can you speak to, obviously understanding that you have client confidences, can you speak to how those deals were initially structured?
Well, I guess in general, yes. In the case of the ACR implementation that I mentioned before, historically that it was used for copyright enforcement purposes and to identify what works were out there and potentially monetize them. Those deals were specific in terms of most of the content owners that we had represented asserted rights into those databases. And the difference here, though, you got to understand at the time, and it's not that long ago, but this just gives you a sense of how quickly the advancements in this area are being implemented and coming about. Back then, the ACR technology and the service providers didn't have the ability to actually code and create these fingerprints and zeros and ones in real time off of broadcasts. They just didn't have that ability. So they relied on the content providers to provide them with the reference database material, i.e. the shows themselves that they then could create the fingerprints of. So they do that, and that was an actual license. It's an express license to do that. So they had leverage. They had the ability to say, okay, you're our service provider. We're using you for DMCA enforcement. We want you to find whatever's out there on MySpace and YouTube that may be infringing so we could either tell YouTube or MySpace to take it down or serve an ad, an overlay over the user-generated content that's up there. Here is a bunch of DVDs or optical media that contains XYZ shows. Create the fingerprints. As between you and us, we own the fingerprints, we own the content that's in your database. You can only use it for a certain particular purpose, i.e. providing service to us. That's not what's going on here.
Anymore. Yeah, this is not Shazam, where which is the same technology, right? The app that you purchase where you put it up to your radio, right? And the application listens to 10 seconds of the song that's playing on the radio and then searches a database, a fingerprint database, the exact same thing that's happening here, and tells you, yeah, you're listening to, Over the Hills and Far Away by Led Zeppelin, right? That's the exact same technology. It's just being applied differently, right? The Shazam is a popular app. Everyone has it on their iPhones, but it's the exact same technology. And so if I'm a copyright holder, right, I'm certainly not I'm not giving up on the argument that I don't own those arguably derivative fingerprints that are attempting in certain instances to damage the value associated with advertising, right? I'm certainly not going to concede that. So where do I go now? Do I partner with the second screen providers, technology companies? Do I go cut a deal with Samsung, LG? How do I make sure that I'm just not in a defensive mode, but I'm also at the table and I'm in control of and adding value to, you know, this new way of experiencing television, right? It's no longer you sit back in your chair. It's interactive. It's changing. It's dynamic. And if I'm a network, I want to be part of this. I want to pitch to my advertisers all of these opportunities associated with my shows, whether it's clothing manufacturers or otherwise. How do I do that? Do I approach these ACR guys, the smart TV guys? I mean, what have you seen happen in the past when there's sort of some gray area on the law and a lot of value?
It really depends on leverage position, because you see clients that have a lot of leverage, already have relationships with these providers, or are even taking equity stakes in some of them, and others that just, you know, are doing business in this space on a routine basis have a bit of leverage in terms of coming to the table and striking a deal. This issue I've seen go silent in these agreements, but it's dealt with in other areas and other ways, so that although there may not be an express license to or an express acknowledgement or reservation of rights over what's in the reference content database, there are prohibitions on what they can do. Namely, they can't provide, you know, competitive advertising or overlays or things that may disrupt their own programming that may appear or be exploited by these ACR providers' applications or technology that's built in the television sets themselves. So that's why I'm saying, when I said initially to the first question, Matt, that all the stakeholders have to cooperate, if you don't get everybody together, you're going to have litigation. You're going to have trouble asserting copyright claims. You have other potential claims, but we can get into that another time. But ultimately, you know, I think the only way that this is going to progress in a big way and scale is if all the stakeholders that have a stake, no pun intended, are actually going to get together and strike some sort of deal that harmonizes their interests.
All right, so Richard, you know, is the smart TV manufacturer now the gorilla? He owns the platform, the technology. He's the one who makes decision, or he or she makes decisions about what technology gets embedded at the point of manufacture to allow for automatic content recognition. So, you know, are the smart TV manufacturers now the gatekeepers for all of this? Are they the one? I mean, they're obviously striking deals with the Yumis, the Rovies, and other entities out there who have this software and technology. But what's their role in all of this? Because at the end of the day, you can't watch TV without a television, obviously, right?
Right now, the way it works is they are providing an application in the TV that does this work that links with the fingerprint database. By the way, for copyright purposes, you have to make a distinction between the copyright in the fingerprint of any one show versus the whole database of everything. The ACR companies have a huge database of everything. And in copyright terms, that would be the selection and arrangement of perhaps non-copyrightable elements. The way their database works, how it accesses the individual fingerprint, how it makes the comparison, all that is clearly copyrightable. And some of the agreements I've seen, the ACR companies claim they own the database, even though the data may have come from somebody else. So, as you say, the best way to do it is to agree in advance as to who owns what or who's going to do what. You don't even need to say who owns it, just who's going to do what and who's going to share the revenue. The other interesting thing now is that as you say, the smart TVs can do anything that a smartphone can do. They have a chip in them that can, it's basically a computer chip that can access the internet, that can do computation. And there are other apps that you can download on your TV, just like you can download apps on your smartphone. What happens when the one app on your TV starts interacting with the ACR app? For example, the web browser on your TV knows that through linking to the ACR software that you're watching, to use your example, you're watching Gossip Girls, and there's an ad for somebody's wearing Gucci shoes. So when you look at Amazon on your web browser that your TV now provides, they put all these ads at the bottom saying this person seems to be interested in Gucci shoes. Let's put on ads for Gucci shoes and other things.
Right, but you're enabling all this technology, right?
I mean,
it all has to work through you, right? The ability to select content on the screen, the ability to have the option to navigate to other applications. You're controlling all of this. It's your proprietary, whether it's a walled garden or not, but this is your proprietary landscape, your computer technology. You are arguably the gatekeeper for all of this, right?
They have both the TV set. And on the TV set, they have an app store just the way your smartphone has an app store. So you can buy apps through them. And depending on the manufacturer, they can exercise a little or a lot of control about what apps get sold. Apple exercises a lot of control over what apps are sold on Apple smartphones. The Android marketplace doesn't do that. So the TV manufacturers can make that choice.
So Sandra, what do I do if I'm, you know, if I'm a content creator, if I own copyrights here? What's my next move here? This is coming, and there's no stopping it. Even though it might not be accessible to a lot of you here today, I just bought a Samsung television, which has a camera on it, which I can play motion control. My son does exercises, and it mimics his motion. I mean, this technology is here, and we're just going through the weeds on what the potential copyright and trademark and other, you know, applicable areas of law implications are. But how do you prepare yourself for this?
Mm-hmm. So I don't think that these are particularly new issues. These are issues that we've been looking at in one guise or another for many, many years since the origins of cable, frankly. I mean, if you look back at the debates over, you know, retransmission consents and the Section 111 licenses, and then later the Section 119 licenses for satellite, for cable first and then satellite, the language in Section 111 licenses for cable specifically makes this an issue. It makes, you know, cutting out of advertisements, replacing of advertisements and manipulation of content an action that is punishable as copyright infringement under the Section 111 licenses. And it actually even foresees the fact that there would be an interest in doing advertising market research. And there's an exception in Section 111 that talks about what you have to do if you want to do advertising market research. And it requires you to go and get the permission of, you know, the parties that are involved, including that the research company has to get the permission of the advertising company that, you know, purchased the original commercial, the broadcaster that's transmitting it, and, you know, all the relevant parties. So this is just to say, you know, this has been going on for a long time. The Copyright Office has been dealing with it. The courts have been dealing with it. I think the sorts of claims that you alluded to in doing the run through the case law are all claims that you're likely to see come up in various contexts. I mean, derivative use claims, derivative works claims are likely to come up in the advertising skipping context or advertising manipulation context. I think, as I mentioned, the Section 111 and Section 119 licenses are something worthwhile pointing to as support for that. I think, like, also, if you look at various copyright opinions, Posner's opinion for the Seventh Circuit and the Amster case has a really good analysis of the Sony Betamax opinion, which shows exactly how narrow that ruling is, and specifically says that in the case where you are skipping over commercials, that you're using the video recorder to skip out commercials, that is a unauthorized derivative use. And that same sort of analysis has been applied in stripping out information in a vertical blanking interval and that sort of activity as well.
But aren't we seeing the needle continually pushed here? So we had Sony, right? We got Cablevision, right? Now we got DVRs. Now we have the Sling Box, which I don't know if anyone knows what the Sling Box is, but that's the ability to basically record television on your home DVR and then access your home DVR over the internet, effectively slinging your television content to wherever you are. So to my knowledge, that hasn't been challenged, right? We just had this ad-skipping case I talked about with Dish. We're recording all of primetime, and now we got, you know, a judge saying that it's likely fair use to automatically cut out commercials, right? Because I remember, you know, 10 years ago, or 15 years ago when I was in law school, you know, Replay TV was one of these first entrants into the market. They were TiVo's biggest competitor, and they were going to automatically cut out commercials, and they got sued out of existence, you know, within 5 minutes, and went bankrupt before you know they could even defend the claim. So Dan, are we just heading in this direction where you know the lines are getting blurred and blurred?
Dish is a little bit bigger than Replay TV.
Well, that's true.
and there are a bunch of other relationships that Dish has with the plaintiffs that are suing them that are coming into play. Are there going to be more lawsuits?
Quick one. You got 1 minute.
Are there going to be more lawsuits? Absolutely. I think. You know, what I found interesting, I don't really have a say on this, I'm not a litigator, but the former Register of Copyrights I read, you know, filed an amicus brief in the Aereo case that clearly believes that, you know, the copyright, the Congress intended to require innovation and innovators like this, services like this, to actually seek, you know, and prove and have the burden of proof to actually persuade Congress that the delivery system like an Aereo is either sanctioned or it should be exempt from copyright liability, which I found was pretty interesting. But I do believe there'll be more litigation on this, again, for stakeholders that feel, like you said, left out from a seat at the table or have something, you know, to enforce that they're not necessarily enforcing or getting from their contractual relationship.
But right. I think the litigation actually comes from the fact that in the Cablevision case, you have a very narrow ruling as to the factual right. scenario, and now you're going to see services, and you are seeing services, either try to jam themselves into that ruling and say that they've, you know, their lawyers have engineered a service that fits into that ruling, or you're going to see services like Sadiva did trying to do something that makes more engineering sense but doesn't fit within that narrow ruling. And you'll see that pattern of cases.
Right. It's the employment of technological inefficiencies. So it
Matt, I don't know how scalable those methodologies are.
Understood. But it's still the idea that businesses are engaging in inefficiencies, putting 1,000 little rings on top of a building so they can fall within the confines of Cablevision. It makes no sense. You have one antenna and you serve the content. But they're following the Cablevision case, and in oral arguments a week ago, the appellate judge asked, does it make any sense for you to put all these rings? Is there any business justification for this at all? The lawyer said, we're just complying with the copyright law that you laid out for us. So there is no justification for it. It was even compared to being a tax haven.
But, you know, one thing that also gets left out in the discussion is there's actually totally setting aside copyright and revenue sorts of streams. There are very valid, like, quality control and customer reliability reasons for content owners to want to have a seat at the table, have information, and make sure that these services work well. When you're in an environment where you're constantly being told, look, you know, customers want services to be reliable, to get what they want, when they want it, how they want it, or we're going to go and pirate the works because we can get a better service someplace else. You don't want, like, a Zadiva, which is available for 4 hours and then maybe not available if somebody else is trying to get the content at the same time, and, you know, you've got to wait. Those aren't reliable and good consumer experiences. And if you don't have that relationship and you aren't in control of, you know, the customer experience, that's a really big downside for a legitimate content owner.
Okay, how about questions? We've got 2 minutes here, so let's do this. You, sir, go ahead.
Richard, when you're advising your client, what about privacy concerns?
I was just going to raise that. We've been talking about all the stakeholders. But not the one stakeholder we haven't talked about is the person who's watching TV at home. An awful lot of private information is being collected about what you're viewing. What are you watching? What are you interested in? Are you interested in buying clothing? Are you interested in information about the actors on the screen? What types of shows do you like to watch? It's an awful lot of detailed information. And there are probably more every day. Privacy statute. So the way I've advised clients to deal with this is to make sure all of this is covered by your privacy policy. Before a consumer can access these applications on their TV set, they've got to read and acknowledge the privacy policy, and the privacy policy has to explain what kind of information you're collecting, whether it's personally identifiable information like the name and email address that you would need to buy something or a credit card, or it's non-personally identifiable information, just you know what city you're in, what zip code you're in, but it doesn't identify you personally, and that might be used for more general demographic information. But there are now statutes. California has one that most people comply with that says you've got to disclose all this on your website.
Any other? Go ahead. Over there.
You're likely not being brought into the conversation because you've probably licensed. It depends on what your license agreement is with American Idol and how your, you know, what your agreement is there. Because American Idol is probably.
American Idol, and none of them have to do with this.
Sorry?
There's 9 million options in American Idol as to what they can do. Like, they option all these different rights.
Mm-hmm.
But none of those options addresses this.
Yeah. I mean, one of the that's kind of a parallel issue to one of the issues that the guilds often raise, which is like a right of publicity type of argument that, you know, you are using my copyrighted performance to sell, you know, the Gucci boots, and I was just given these Gucci boots from wardrobe to wear them in my copyrighted performance, and now I'm suddenly being commercialized, and my, you know, collective bargaining agreement says that my copyrighted performance isn't to be used for, you know, commercial purposes without separately negotiating for it. It depends on what your contract says is kind of the bottom line. So we have to look at it offline.
Well, maybe we can pick this. Well, I mean, how are we doing on time, Craig? Do you want to wrap it up or? Okay, yeah, if you'd like to excuse yourself, I mean, maybe we'll do a couple more minutes of questions, and if you got to go, please feel free to head out. No offense taken.
A little offense.
Okay, a little offense taken. This is enthralling stuff. How dare you? No. So can we do another question? Go ahead.
Yes, I occasionally work with these fingerprinting and watermark vendors, and I'm wondering, heard a lot of mixed things about whether they may be liable or whether services that use this technology may be liable. And so I'm wondering if there's any theory you can think of under which a fingerprinting type service would be contributorily liable with some of these business models.
Liable for what? Under what circumstances?
Copyright infringement you're talking about?
I mean, I think the argument would potentially be that the service is committing copyright infringement by how the technology operates. If they're making, for instance, an entire copy of the underlying work in order to facilitate the matching of the work minute by minute and not doing it on the fly, as Richard was describing, then there's, you know, a recording being made, and that's a violation of the reproduction right.
In this case, you'd have to make a temporary buffer copy, and that's all you'll need.
I mean, I think it's an analysis of what does the technology do. So for the...
You could be facilitating the ads in a dynamic ad replacement situation, and that could be a violation of the derivative work right. You can be modifying something that's already there, that was supposed to be there, and you're modifying. There are arguments to be made, and I guess the question is whether it's direct infringement or contributory infringement. And, you know, you have to get there first. We're not just talking about the creation. I guess we were talking about the creation of the fingerprints, and that may not be copyrightable at all. Arguably, it could be, and we just don't know. But ultimately, what you're saying is there depends on the implementation of the technology, right, that there could be certain infringements going on just on based on the implementation, the facilitation of that service provider to allow an advertiser to do what it's doing.
All right. Well, let's thank our panelists with a round of applause here. And if you have any further questions, I'm sure they'll hang around for a bit. Thank you.